Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning will be Myrick against Wellpoint. Mr. Krisloff.
Good morning, Judge Easterbrook, Judge Bauer, Judge Williams. While we think that this case should have been remanded, and we still think that, if the court kept it, then it should have dealt with what is a real corporate abuse with real injuries to people, which the court could have and should have pursued. Wellpoint captured its target, which was the highly dominant and profitable Blue Cross of Missouri business, and in order to maximize that profit, stripped away the renewal rights of the 12,000 Illinois Right Choice policyholders thereafter. And that was, of course, after having told everyone that they had no intention of changing things materially either in Illinois or Missouri. Clearly what they did was a ruse, but even if it wasn't a ruse and even if the plan was not decided upon until after the acquisition, court below never reached the fundamental unfairness count of the Consumer Fraud Act in Illinois, which was a perverse parsing of HIPAA's protections. What Wellpoint contrived to avoid was the 5-year prohibition on selling policies if you withdraw from the market. There are two ways to not renew somebody's policy if they're willing to pay the renewal. One is to have a policy, a product termination, meaning you're not selling that policy anymore. But then you have to give the policyholders the choice to pick whatever other policy you're selling without consideration of their health considerations. You can do a market withdrawal, meaning you're withdrawing all business from the state of Illinois. But in order to do that, you are prohibited from selling for the next 5 years in Illinois. What they contrived to do was to do what they admitted was likely what could be viewed as a product withdrawal without offering the policyholders the right to pick a policy. And indeed, what they did is they said, we're doing a market withdrawal and we will, for those of you who do, but you can all apply as strangers to our Unicare affiliate and be repriced, re-rated, re-underwritten, and if you're not acceptable or if you don't do anything, you'll automatically be converted into the Unicare 1000 policy, which was so expensive that the 8,000 people who were automatically converted into it were 1 year later down to, I believe, 350, and 2 years later there were 150 out of the 8,000 people who had been converted into it. The policy was clearly too expensive for any of them to afford. And what we're talking about are the people who, by definition, are not acceptable to any company as a normal insured.
Can I just ask you, I'd like to hear a little bit more about jurisdiction and citizenship.
Sure.
And you're familiar with our case, the Sprint Nextel case, where we held that a court can't draw conclusions about the citizenship of class members on things like their phone numbers and mailing addresses. And isn't that essentially what you're doing here? Or as an alternative, you're pointing to company billing addresses.
Well,
how is that relevant to show citizenship, and how do you distinguish?
Citizenship for these purposes, because of the way it comes about, it's a little different than if we had pled citizenship in the first place. The fact is, individuals who are residents of Illinois and are citizens of the United States are citizens of Illinois if they're resident in Illinois. There were an overwhelming number of those, like 12,000. There were also 697 entities.
Counsel, I understood my colleague to be asking how your position is consistent with this circuit's case law.
Sir. Okay.
And your going back and just describing the facts of this suit isn't helping.
Sorry.
If you could address the question.
We identified from their mailing addresses and from the fact that they had to be Illinois residents to be on the policies. That was required by Wellpoint. Plus the U.S. Census.
There's a problem.
Would really wish you to address our circuit's case law.
Well, but Sprint is different because if you have an area code, basically, cell phones go all over the United States. People move with them. It doesn't indicate where they are at any given time. And so in order to figure out who of the original people who were clearly residents and likely citizens, because these were individual policyholders, these were not corporate executives who moved about and might be, these are people who had individual health care policies, and so were probably many of them either self-employed or unemployed. We're not talking about multi-district people. We're talking about individuals. And for the ill who were unacceptable, it is highly likely that that's the only place they lived, worked.
Okay, so what I think you are saying is that in your view, Sprint deals with a problem created by number portability in the phone business?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I have a factual question about what happened in the district court. Did you ask the district court to hold a hearing under Rule 12b-1? 12b-1 is the rule that deals with arguments about jurisdiction.
If there are disputed
issues of fact pertinent to jurisdiction, a hearing is held under Rule 12b-1. Now, it sounds very much like we have a dispute about issues of fact pertinent to jurisdiction. Did you ask for a hearing under Rule 12b-1?
We didn't ask for a hearing. We moved for remand, and the court...
Yes, but whether remand is appropriate depends on knowing domicile of the people in the plaintiff class. That, one would think, is a question on which a hearing would be useful. Your view, the view at least as expressed in your brief, and I must say that the defendant's view, seems to be that federal subject matter jurisdiction is determined by lawyers' arguments rather than by facts. And normally, one thinks, if there's a dispute, we look into the facts. That's what Rule 12b-1 is all about.
I'm with you there. I think we both identified that the facts were the residency.
No, fact doesn't have, fact is not residence, it's citizenship that matters. That's one of the problems.
I understand that.
You introduced evidence from which one might infer residence, at least residence as of 2002. And the defendant says, well, residence may be different from domicile. And anyway, they may have moved by 2010 when the suit was filed and may be domiciled in a different place. So there's a dispute about how many people have moved, and there's a potential dispute about how many people have residence but not domicile.
And that's why we brought in the fact.
And that's why one would think we need a hearing. And I'm just perplexed that neither side seems to have thought about resolving a factual dispute bearing on jurisdiction by having a hearing.
Well, I think we both thought that we had submitted facts. We submitted as well.
Yes, both sides submit facts. Right. There is a material dispute. When both sides submit facts and there's a material dispute, what happens in federal court?
Well, sometimes
we have a hearing.
We would have liked to have had a hearing on something on this case. Everything was done in the paper. The only evidence
that's
on
why
this
I asked if you had asked for a hearing, and obviously the answer is no. The
right.
thought never entered your head.
In that respect, no. We did submit. We were the only ones who submitted evidence, in which was the Census Bureau's report on the mobility and how many people who are here. Are here next year and the year after. That's why we submitted the Census Bureau's evidence as to mobility as the submission of facts. What they submitted in response were not evidence, was only speculation that some people may have moved. They did not submit any evidence. If there was not a dispute over the facts, the evidence that was submitted, there was only a dispute over what the conclusion is from that. And I believe that we submitted what we had enough to show the citizenship to the extent we had to show it. It's hard in a country where you don't have citizenship cards.
and they didn't have to submit citizenship cards for their insurance policies, but they had to have residence, and they certainly had an intent to remain because they were going to be there for the year that they'd purchased the policy for. In any event, we do believe that the case should have been remanded on those facts. Also, there clearly was no ERISA basis for, although the district judge never reached it. There was Sunoco as interpreting as well. This court's Jass case made it clear that there was no ERISA jurisdiction. But fundamentally, the wrong that was done here was ignored by the court, which was to evade the HIPAA protections for people's renewal rights. The class also should have been certified because it was eminently feasible to certify the class, give declaratory relief on the wrong of WellPoint's.
I must say, counsel, I am really puzzled by this argument about class certification. The plaintiffs have lost this case on the merits, and you seem determined to make sure everybody else goes down in flames with your clients. Why does that show that you're responsible representatives of the missing parties?
Your Honor, we show in our briefs that the wrong that was done was actionable, that summary judgment was wrongly granted.
That's what you claim, but you have in fact lost this suit, and your brief asked for a class to be certified, not contingent on a remand on the merits, but unconditionally. So the current status of this case is clients have lost, and you're determined that everybody else should lose too. And I can't see that as demonstrating that your clients are fit representatives of the others.
Well, Your Honor, I think I respectfully disagree. I guess I would agree if the court thinks that the judge below should be upheld on his summary judgment rule.
No, you're not getting the point.
I understand. What
you are arguing that the class should first be certified and then we should decide the merits. This is in a case in which you've lost. And this circuit affirms something like 89% of all district court decisions that come to it. So the most probable outcome on the merits is that we will affirm. And if the class is then certified, you lose. In fact, you're very lucky that the class was not certified in the first of these cases, SEMA, if that's how it's pronounced, because then this suit would be barred by principles of preclusion. This is all very weird to me. The defendants opposed class certification in SEMA, and if they had favored class certification and the class had been certified, this suit would be impossible. And the argument you're making is, let's make sure nobody else can sue either. I would have thought that was the defendant's argument.
I understand that, but the way that the class rules have evolved was that when they were first drafted, it was thought that the defendants would want class certification so that they could get dispositive relief against the whole class. I would agree that if the court affirms the decision below, then the plaintiffs lose, but the class is not barred.
What your brief says. Your brief asks for class certification, period. Well, I could imagine an argument that says, look, Seventh Circuit, if you remand to the district court for more proceedings on the merits, then tell the district judge to certify the class. That would be unconditionally beneficial to your clients, but that's not what you requested.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and I think I would agree that then the right posture is to reach the merits, to reach the summary judgment first, reverse that, and then send back down with instructions to. At this point, what I don't know, Your Honor, is whether you would think that the best structure is to say, go back down, take a look at class certification, because and in the hopes that they will certify and then find and then deal with the unfairness of the substantive actions, or that we should, in some respects, do what the drafters thought plaintiffs would do always, which is avoid the class certification decision until absolutely the end so that you get the decision on the merits, which is then binding against the defendants. The the fundamental wrong that was done here, stripping the people of their renewal rights, was never addressed under the consumer fraud unfairness count. The court below dealt only with the deception count, which we think we had enough to go to the jury on anyway, because fundamentally WellPoint wanted, for sure, wanted to acquire the Blue Cross of Missouri business, had no interest in the Right Choice business, had no desire to continue that business, and that in itself, followed by their very quick deletion of that, the market with the contrived market withdrawal, would have been enough for a jury to decide that it was deceptive when they first did it, but it was unfair that they did it, regardless of when it was concocted. And the fundamental issue of how to, the judge below felt that he couldn't certify it because it would be unmanageable, because he'd have to deal with thousands of different policies. All the policies are the same in this respect. They are all governed by and incorporate the HIPAA protections, which are required to be included in every contract of insurance. And so the decision, and getting back to what the purpose of the declaration on a B2 class would be, is that the legality of their of WellPoint's actions in doing this, in the manner in which they did it, whether that is legal or illegal, fair or unfair, deceptive or not, applies identically for all class members. And from that, all people who paid either under new policies that were repriced, re-underwritten, or whatever, or were automatically converted into the Unicare 1000 policy, those people can all have their damages computed just from WellPoint's records, which will show what the policy charges were that people paid and what they would have been renewed at without consideration for their health care conditions, which is fundamentally the reason that we buy health insurance, which is to ensure that we will be able to renew every year without respect to our health condition, which will eventually get worse. It's not auto insurance, and it cannot be treated that way. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I could.
Certainly. Mr. Krislav? Ms. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. I may just start a timer. Good morning. Your Honor, in this court's decision last week, reversing class certification in Parker versus Shell Oil, the court made an important statement. Nothing is simpler than to make an unsubstantiated allegation. That statement captures the essence of this litigation, and I believe explains in large part all six orders that are before the court this morning. And I think this is best exemplified by contrasting Judge Gilbert's characterization of Appley's conduct.
I think we need to start with jurisdiction.
Sure.
This looks, just to a naive observer like us, at least like me, like a 100% Illinois case. This is a policy offered under Illinois law to people who live in Illinois, represent that they are Illinois citizens. And yet, your position is that, well, at least a third of the members of the class must be non-Illinoisans. What sense can that make?
Well, Your Honor, what it does is comply specifically with CAFA. There's no dispute that Appley's have...
It says that if more than two-thirds of the class members are from a single state, the case must be remanded. Now, what we know is that the
policy was offered only in Illinois, that essentially everybody who bought the policy represented that he lived in Illinois, we have two things bothered Judge Gilbert. One is domicile may not be the same as residence. Well, domicile isn't the same as residence. We don't know what percentage of the buyers were resident in Illinois but not domiciled there. And the other is that people may have moved between 2002 and 2010. Those are both potential questions. Why don't we have a hearing and figure it out?
Well, Your Honor, if I may, your first factual premise is not correct, and there are facts in the record to show that. The class is not comprised only of individual policyholders. They are the only ones who had to be Illinois residents in 2002. There are
corporations are the policyholders when the corporations buy for the benefit of their employees. They are the ones whose citizenship would matter under the diversity jurisdiction.
But the class, I'm sorry, the class right. also includes on the group side, not just the group policyholders. If you look at paragraphs 108 and 109 of plaintiff's complaint, the class also includes the 12,000 group members.
It's not clear that they are proper as class members.
They are alleged by plaintiff, and I would suggest that whether they're proper class members is a determination the court would make not in determining CAFA jurisdiction, mm-hmm. but when it looks at the court. And I would suggest...
If you think that's a problem, it sounds like we need a hearing even more. We need to find out what percentage of the employees who are beneficiaries of these plans are Illinois domiciliaries and what percentage aren't.
Your Honor,
you know, and one would think this is a perfectly straightforward thing to do statistically. Draw 50 individual policyholders, 50 corporate policyholders, find out where they are domiciliaries of, and then use statistical methods to figure out what that tells you about the class as a whole. And even hire a professional statistician who can tell you what degree of confidence you have in the outcome. If it turns out that 90% of them are from Illinois, then this suit goes to state court. If it turns out 50% are from Illinois, the suit stays in federal court. If it's close to two-thirds, we probably need a larger sample. Sounds like a perfectly straightforward way to resolve the dispute.
Your Honor, plaintiff's counsel requested and was granted leave by the trial court to take discovery. They served discovery. Defendants responded to the questions that were asked.
We have discovery. We have a disputed issue of material fact. And when after discovery we got a disputed issue of material fact, the thing that happens next is a hearing. That's what perplexes me.
Your Honor, the way CAFA is set up and the way this court has held the burdens fall, it was Appellee's burden to establish CAFA jurisdiction, which CAFA...
Yeah, and we have a disputed issue of material fact. In every piece of civil litigation, somebody has the burden. But I hope you don't say that means we never have trials in federal court.
No.
We have trials all the time.
Your Honor, when...
And we have hearings all the time.
When the district court looked at the evidence submitted by plaintiff, he found it did not satisfy the establishing
no,
the exception.
No, he found that we couldn't tell for sure whether residence was domicile and how many people had moved.
He also held...
We can't find for sure is the normal run-up to a hearing.
Well,
I'm just... utterly perplexed by what happened here.
Well, what also happens is when the burden is on a party and that party fails to meet the burden on an issue that's not jurisdictional, because establishing the CAFA exceptions is not jurisdictional. Judge Williams pointed out Sprint v. Nextel. It was very clear to Merrick and his counsel what he needed to do. In fact, if you look at their remand papers, counsel states, well, if we need to do a survey, we can. When this court, and Judge Williams and Judge Bauer, you were both on that panel, perhaps it was Judge Wood, I know you were Judge Easterbrook, sent the case back.
It does not matter who is on any panel in this court. Opinions speak for the court.
Thank you. When this court rejected the interlocutory appeal on remand, it specifically stated you were not precluding further consideration. Merrick did not choose to do more discovery, to ask for a hearing, to take a survey, to change his class definition to be citizens. The way CAFA is set up, the burden was on plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff didn't meet that burden.
This is a federal subject matter jurisdiction.
That's correct.
The Supreme Court has said that when there is a dispute about the underlying facts, there must be a hearing. Jurisdiction, when there's a dispute, cannot be resolved on lawyers say so, on the papers. That's why there is Rule 12b-1. On your view, there would never be any use for 12b-1 hearings, because somebody's always got a burden, and if the judge doesn't think it's satisfied, then there's never any hearing. The Supreme Court has held otherwise. It's held that jurisdiction is not just something that's resolved on the papers.
So, Your Honor, I would, again, reiterate that both this Court's decision in Morrison, which has since been followed by other circuits, the exceptions to CAFA are not jurisdictional. And I would suggest that Merrick's failure to meet its burden, his burden, has been waived and cannot be sent back down to the trial court again after all these years and the opportunities to establish those facts. Your Honor, I'd like to turn to the questions that you posed about the merits of the case. And those merits go to the unsubstantiated allegations that I mentioned with respect to PERCO. In characterizing the appellee's conduct in the SEMA case, which was, of course, based on the allegations of that complaint, which are virtually identical to the allegations here, and then contrasting that to Judge Gilbert's ruling on the motion for summary judgment on the unfairness prong of the Consumer Fraud Act, which, contrary to Mr. Krislov's assertion, was specifically decided by the court. And the language that I'm referring to was quoted by Merrick several times in his briefs to this court, both in opening and reply. And in the motion to dismiss, Judge Gilbert characterized Appley's conduct as immoral, oppressive, unethical, and unscrupulous. Those words are the boilerplate used by the Illinois Supreme Court as factors in finding unfairness under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. But when Judge Gilbert later looked at the uncontroverted evidence as opposed to the unsubstantiated allegations, he ruled in favor of defendant appellees, holding that there was no violation of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. In short, the allegations of the complaint and this oft-quoted language from SEMA were not supported by the uncontroverted evidence. Now, Merrick's use of the law is as flawed as his articulation of the facts. Merrick misrepresents key cases and argues for rulings unsupported by the evidence. Now, the district court cut through all of this, cut through the spin, and looked at the relevant case law. And when he did so, the district court specifically found that appellees did not make a misrepresentation to the Illinois Department of Insurance in the Form A, did not violate the renewability provisions of HIPAA, and did not violate the public policy of Illinois. And as a result, the court held that there was no breach of contract and no violation of the Consumer Fraud Act. Indeed, when the district court cut through this spin and analyzed the precedents, it ruled in favor of defendant appellees on all six orders that are on appeal today. The court denied the motion for remand, granted the motion to dismiss the HIPAA claims, denied class certification, granted summary judgment to defendants on all remaining counts, awarded costs to defendants as the prevailing parties, and issued a sua sponte order adverse to Merrick on discovery. Based on the law and the evidence in this case, on the record that has come up after years of litigation and years of discovery, this court should affirm all six orders. I'd like to respond to the questions of the court and some comments made by Mr. Krislov this morning. First, with respect to the substantive counts and claims and the policies under HIPAA. Mr. Krisloff suggested that the policies were all the same because they all had the same HIPAA language. But the policies differed as to copay, deductibles, coverage, which means that whether any member of the class had an injury for the breach of contract or the Consumer Fraud Act claim depends upon his or her particular circumstances. For example, if you look at the actuarial science, Mr. Krisloff talked about insurance, health insurance, not being like auto insurance. Health insurance premiums are set on the premise that some people will pay more in premiums than they get in benefits, and some will get more in benefits than they get in premiums. And in every year that this case has continued from 2002 to the present, a court looking to see whether there was a breach of contract or a Consumer Fraud Act injury would have to look. Was that putative class member one of the lucky ones? For example, the class includes the covered family members of the individual insureds. Let's take a child, a 17-year-old. That child or that child's parents might decide when Rick terminated coverage that he would go without insurance. And in the next 2 years before he went off the plan, or would have had to go off the plan because he aged out at age 19, he might have not had any injuries, illnesses, or going to the doctor. So it cost less for him than it would have if he had paid the premium. There were a lot of children insured under the RIC plan. Let's take the other extreme. A person who was very ill or had a history, someone who was cancer, a cancer survivor. Perhaps she couldn't get coverage, underwritten coverage, one of the persons Mr. Krisloff is talking about. But she's in remission. And the costs that she pays for her checkups are less than it would have cost her in insurance premiums, co-pays, and deductibles. She might not have been injured. Let's take a look at the group members. Under the group plans, if an employer chose to take the guaranteed issue product, that was at a rate that was 17.5%, not 250%, 17.5% higher than the highest Unicare rate. Perhaps that employer absorbed all the cost, didn't pass it on to its employees, the covered class members. They would have had no injury. Or if the employer did pass it on, would that increase be higher than the premiums would have been otherwise? I would suggest that in looking at this case, looking at the claims of Mr. Merrick on summary judgment, at the facts establishing jurisdiction, and at the individual issues for predominance under class certification, that the district court's rulings were in keeping with the facts and the law and should be affirmed by this court. The court has no further questions. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Weinstein. Anything further, Mr. Krisloff?
Yes, sir.
Number one, they never deal with the fact that Judge Gilbert's decision on unfairness was just based on his belief that they had not crafted the market withdrawal plan at the time they filed the Form A getting approval for the merger. The unfairness, though, stems from, as he originally said in SEMA, beyond its representations to the IDOI, WellPoint's conscious manipulation of the requirements in Illinois HIPAA to re-rate or re-rid itself of those most in need of health insurance is certainly immoral, oppressive, unethical, and unscrupulous. It is the fact of what they did that the court should not let them get away with. Diana Peake, who is the woman that one of the people we represented in SEMA. She didn't get a benefit because her cancer was in remission. She had terminal brain cancer. She had insurance, and then she didn't have insurance, and she died on Medicaid. They do not escape so easy to say, well, there's all sorts of different things that people might have incurred in expenses. The fundamental wrong here was that the people these policyholders had a right to renew those policies without consideration for their health conditions, as it would decline, theoretically as it would improve, whatever. They had a right to renew those policies. And the evasion here was shown by the fact that every witness that we posed this to on WellPoint, we said, well, if the argument is okay, is that we can just say we're withdrawing this company, but we will automatically convert you to one of our other companies, which you can apply to, you can apply to, and if they won't accept you, we'll automatically convert you at a policy you can't afford. What they could have done just as well was to say that this Little Ricky, which was the term that they called the Right Choice Insurance of Illinois, they could, that Right Choice could have said, look, we are terminating Little Ricky, but we just created a new company, Little Lucy, which we are going to let you apply to, and if you can't qualify, we're going to convert you to Little Lucy. And it, and every one of them acknowledged that it would be wrong. It would be wrong for a company to do that. It would utterly violate HIPAA. HIPAA was there to protect against precisely what they did. And in the interpretation of the policies as being different, the fact is it was in the renewal and the protection of the right to renew, which is the fundamental important thing about guaranteed renewable health insurance. The whether they did it as a misrepresentation, whether they did it as a misrepresentation to the Department of Insurance, it was unfair, and this court should not allow them to get away with it, and it should remand.
Thank you, Mr. Krislov.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.